It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Thera. There are now more than 5,000 data centers across the United States, including about 50 here in Wisconsin.
Technology companies have invested trillions of dollars in these centers. Those investments have been credited with keeping the economy humming, despite other signs of an economic downturn. But some economists have said that the AI boom could actually be a bubble about to burst.
We wanted to get a sense of how much these centers are changing Wisconsin's communities, environment, and economy, and what 2026 might hold. WPR reporter Joe Schultz has been following the data center boom in Wisconsin. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You've been covering the development of data centers for a while. We've been talking about them a lot on this show, too. Are you surprised, like I am, about how much this issue has blown up just in the last, what, half year, 8 months or so?
A little bit. I mean, the pushback this year has definitely gotten a lot more pronounced than it was, you know, when, I mean, I remember when former President Biden came to Wisconsin to announce Microsoft's project in Mount Pleasant. And yeah, it's just, the pushback has really intensified in recent months, it feels like. And there's been, you know, more subsequent announcements since then as well.
Right. The quantity of projects and the size of some of them, it seems like there. If I've got a big chunk of land with nothing on it in Wisconsin, somebody's going to come to me and want to build a data center. Talk a little bit about how much this is spreading and mushrooming in Wisconsin.
Well, Microsoft expects to finish the first phase of its data center campus in Mount Pleasant next year. In September, the company announced plans to invest $4 billion in a second data center as part of that campus. Port Washington, you know, has approved a development agreement for a data center campus in that community, and that one broke ground recently. And then, you know, opponents for that project have also started a recall petition for the mayor. You know, and then Meta just a couple months ago, you know, Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, revealed that they're the developer behind a data center campus in Beaver Dam. And then another company, QTS Data Centers, is hoping to build a similar campus in Dane County.
Now, before we get too far into this, remind us, what happens in a data center? What do they do?
So in general, data centers contain a lot of servers that are used to run like websites and apps and AI systems. And they store a whole bunch of data. Those servers consume a lot of energy, and they generate heat, so they also rely on reliable electricity and advanced cooling systems. And I think a lot of the ones in Wisconsin are going to be like AI data centers. I know, like, yeah, they're like the hyperscaler data centers.
One of the hopes, if you get a data center in your community, is that there will be jobs in the construction and then the operation. What do we know so far about the job impact of these projects?
So the construction jobs is where the bulk of the job creation from data centers is going to come from. Earlier this year, Governor Evers said that more than 3,000 construction workers have worked on Microsoft's first data center in Mount Pleasant so far. And then, you know, Meta says that they're expecting to have more than 1,000 construction jobs and then only about 100 construction jobs when that campus is completed. So really, like, the big impact is those, you know, these are thousands of construction jobs. And then operational jobs, it's going to be much smaller.
You mentioned pushback in many communities. In some cases, that has stopped projects or paused them. In some cases, as you mentioned, recall campaigns targeting local officials. When people are objecting to these data centers, what kind of concerns have you heard them raising?
A lot of the pushback has been around concerns about the amount of energy and water that these data center campuses are going to use. A recent analysis by the nonprofit Clean Wisconsin found that Microsoft's data center campus in Mount Pleasant and the data center campus being developed in Port Washington could use more power than all the homes in Wisconsin. And then there were also concerns in Beaver Dam about a lack of transparency around that project because the city approved a development agreement for it about a year before Meta publicly revealed that it was the developer behind the project. But water and energy are kind of the two big ones.
I've talked to some people who are organizing local campaigns against data centers, and they've told me anyway that they're starting to make connections from one community to another. You know, where if I'm opposing this in town B, well, I'm talking to the person in city C over there, and we're comparing notes and things like that. Have you seen that when you're talking to people who object to these data centers, people seeing this as a local issue, but then starting to connect the dots and see it as a wider issue?
Not a ton. You know, I went to Meta's announcement in Beaver Dam, and there were about a dozen protesters outside. There were a few that weren't from the community. And then, you know, many of them were, you know, like residents. Not a ton. I know there were those data center protests kind of across Wisconsin. And, you know, this is an issue that Charlie Behrens, the comedian, was raising some concern about. You know, a lot of my conversations with, I guess, data center opponents are some of the environmental groups that are concerned about, you know, to meet the electricity demand for these projects, we're going to have to build more electric generation. And utilities are looking at building natural gas power plants and investing in natural gas. They're also investing in, you know, renewable energy as well. But I think the big concern from some of the environmental groups that I've talked to has been this could really derail efforts to get Wisconsin's energy generation to be carbon neutral. And then, you know, there's also some concerns about the water and the Great Lakes as well.
Of course, not everyone is against these projects. What kind of hopes have you heard from people, politicians or others who are supporting these projects?
Well, one of the big kind of key things I think for local officials has been, you know, this is going to be new construction in their communities. This is going to bring additional property value to their communities. This is something that that some of the local leaders that I've talked to, you know, they say that it will allow them to boost their property taxes without boost their property tax revenue without having to, you know, tax homeowners and, you know, small business owners more, because these are going to be, you know, there's going to be a lot of property value caught up in the data centers. And that's, you know, a lot of local governments are strapped for funding. You know, whether it's, you know, small towns trying to afford an ambulance or a fire department or, you know, even local school districts, you know, so I think that's kind of what the local officials that are behind these projects are really kind of seeing, is they're seeing it as a way to boost property tax value without, you know, raising taxes on residents, because these are like multi-billion dollar projects.
We're talking about what happened with data centers across Wisconsin in 2025. Joe Schultz is with us, WPR reporter. He's been following this issue. Now, at the state and federal level, there have been efforts to regulate data centers and AI in one way or another. President Trump signed an executive order saying, hey, states, you are limited in your ability to regulate AI. A lot of open questions there. We won't get into that. But here in Wisconsin, Joe, you wrote about a bill introduced in the state legislature that had to do with the energy sources, the wages at data centers. What was that? Where is it in the legislature?
Yeah, so it's been introduced, but there hasn't been a ton of movement on it yet. It was officially introduced, according to the legislature website, in early December. And, you know, the way that it was kind of explained to me by one of the co-sponsors was that it's meant to fill a regulatory void in Wisconsin. The lawmaker that I talked to, you know, mentioned that really, the main mention of data centers in state law right now is for tax incentives. We've got a sales and use tax exemption for data centers, and this aims to provide some guardrails. It would make sure that, you know, the workers building the data centers are receiving either prevailing wages or union wages covered under a collective bargaining agreement. And, you know, it looks to kind of protect the workers, and then also, you know, make sure that data centers receive at least 70% of their annual electricity from renewable sources. And it ties, you know, some of the subsidies that are already on the books for data centers to those labor and renewable energy investment goals. So that would kind of, another lawmaker kind of described it as like, you know, if we're going to make public tax dollars available to private corporations, we need to make sure that there's family sustaining jobs, and we need to make sure that these investments are benefiting the public. So it's, yeah, really just trying to like get some more guardrails in place to protect the people building these, and then, you know, try to make sure that, you know, renewable energy is being used to power them.
All right, Joe, let's look ahead now at 2026. So this last year, you report on a lot. I follow your reporting. You report on more than just data centers. I feel like you could have had a full-time job just following all the data center stories in the state this year. 2026, do you think we're going to see the same kind of trends? More of this, a lot of work in progress there. What are you watching for in this next year?
I mean, I think the projects that have already been started, it'll be interesting to see just kind of where those end up. You know, I mean, I think, just kind of like, do these projects follow through? And then I think the pushback is really going to be interesting. There's an effort to recall the mayor of Port Washington. We'll see what happens there. And then I think maybe in local elections in April, you know, you could see some things start to shift due to some of the opposition to data centers. I think the public has gotten pretty skeptical in a way that they weren't when these projects started being announced. And then, you know, I think the companies behind some of these projects are also like, you know, talking about ways that they want to invest and partner with communities. So Meta made some promises about helping restore wetland and prairie kind of around where they're going to build their data center. And then, you know, Microsoft is partnering with UW-Milwaukee on a manufacturing kind of something with AI and manufacturing. And I think like seeing where some of those partnerships go will be interesting. And then, you know, I think any new data centers that get built in Wisconsin are just going to face more opposition at the local level, at the local government meetings where they're happening. It'll be interesting to see if anything happens with that bill. There's a whole lot. And then as these things come online, what are the impacts? You know, like what utility projects end up getting approved? When we start getting some more hard numbers on, you know, how much water and energy some of these things are going to need, I think that's going to be interesting. I mean, I think this is going to be an issue that's going to be here for a while.
Joe, we'll leave it there. Thanks for bringing us up to date.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Joe Schultz is a WPR reporter who covers northeastern Wisconsin, business and energy issues. He's been following the AI data center boom in Wisconsin. You can follow his reporting in the new year at WPR.org. Coming up, a barrier is in the works to block the spread of invasive carp into the Great Lakes. We'll find out how the race against the clock is going.
They do threaten a $7 billion a year fishing industry and recreational industry on the Great Lakes.
That conversation is next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A project to prevent invasive carp from entering Wisconsin's Great Lakes via a choke point near Joliet, Illinois, has been in the works for years. In May, it finally got the go-ahead after being paused. The holdup came after the federal funding freeze nationwide led Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker to halt the project until the Trump administration confirmed they'd maintain their commitment to help pay for the $1.2 billion plan. The project at the Brandon Road Lock and Dam will use bubble curtains, electrical fields, and sound to keep the carp from the Illinois River out of Lake Michigan. Two state DNR officials join us now for a look at the project and keeping invasive carp out of Wisconsin waters. Amy Kretlow is the Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator at the Wisconsin DNR, and Wade Strickland is Director of the DNR's Office of Great Waters. Wade, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Amy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Amy, let's start with you. Before we get into the practicalities of keeping Asian carp out of the Great Lakes waterways, I want to talk about the why. We've been hearing about these guys for a long time. We have a lot of invasive species in the Great Lakes ecosystems. Why are we worried particularly about Asian carp?
Well, if Asian carp do get into the Great Lakes, they could really start to disrupt the food web in the Great Lakes. The carp that we're really worried about is our silver and bighead carp, which are filter feeders, and they do consume very large quantities of plankton. And plankton are the base of our aquatic food web, and they're with them being filter feeders, it could really reduce food availability for fish like yellow perch, lake whitefish, juvenile game fish, and alewives and bloaters.
Wade, this is a tale of two water systems, the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River. Wisconsin, of course, parts of it drain into each of those. And we have this man-made connection between the two. Can you talk about this artificial waterway and why this is now the front line in keeping the Asian carp from moving from the Mississippi, where it is and has gotten into the Great Lakes?
Yeah, the Illinois waterway has been constructed over 125, 150 plus years, and it's been engineered so there was a connection from the Great Lakes down to the Mississippi River and vice versa. Right now, we've got invasive carp right around Joliet, Illinois. So the Brandon Road Lock and Dam is actually positioned in that area. And folks have been working really hard through overfishing, intentional overfishing of Asian carp to kind of keep them there while we work on the Brandon Road project.
Now, talk us through the Brandon Road project. I almost seems like a horror movie, and the monsters are coming, and we are trying to build this wall to keep them from breaking through. What is happening in this lock and dam?
Yeah, so it's about a $1.4 billion project. It's been in the works, under discussion and design and planning for about 10 years. And in that lock, the proposal is to include a bunch of different deterrents that would keep invasive carp from moving further towards the Great Lakes. Things like bubble curtains, acoustic deterrents, large engineered channels that we can put additional control measures on, and actually a flushing lock to keep the fish moving downstream.
Wade, what is a bubble curtain?
So a bubble curtain, if you can think of just bubbles coming out of an aquarium, think of it like that, but it's fixed. The main one we're kind of thinking about or talking about now is one that's fixed on the riverbed, and it bubbles up really large bubbles, and the fish try to swim through them, and they get frustrated, and they head back downstream. The other thing that it helps do is other aquatic invasive species that move upstream, those bubbles will actually detach them from the bottoms of the barges and have them discharged downstream as well.
Now, Amy, part of the story is watching and observation. What do you do as part of your job to watch for where Asian carp are in Wisconsin, whether that's where we're really worried about now, the Great Lakes Basin, or the waterways connected to the Mississippi Basin?
So in the Great Lakes, we do work collaboratively with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And each year, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service talks with Wisconsin, and we develop a monitoring plan that includes eDNA. And each year, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does go out and they collect water samples in some of our major harbors, such as the Milwaukee Harbor and up in Green Bay. And we check for any kind of DNA from these silver or big head carp.
Wade, can you talk about the collaboration going on between different units and levels of government?
Yeah, so Wisconsin participates in something called the Great Lakes Commission. And the Great Lakes Commission has all of the eight Great Lakes states sitting on it. And this topic, the Brandon Road Project, has been something that we've been talking about for 10, 15 years, really to kind of coalesce around an idea of what might work, where we might need to install these technologies, and how to get that funded. There's been a lot of work with the federal government to get funding secured. At one point, it was a 65 and 35 federal state cost share split, and we've gotten it up to 90-10 cost share split. And with the recent federal administration, there's been a memo that came out from the White House that has voiced support for this particular project. So that's been really great to see as well.
And Wade, that part of the story is huge. There's concern. A lot of funding that people previously assumed was coming from the federal government was canceled or blocked or delayed for review, things like that. And I understand that led Illinois at one point to say, well, hold on, we don't know if we can proceed with this because we don't know if the cash is there. It seems like all parties at the table agree that the money is there and that all this stuff can go forward. Do I have that right?
Yeah, Illinois and Michigan have been the non-federal monetary sponsors. So they've each contributed $50 million for Illinois and $64 million for Michigan. And with those investments, they wanted some assurances from the federal government that the project would move forward. based on that request, the White House did produce that memo that said, we agree, we will fund this project. It's an important project to keep the Great Lakes free of invasive carp. So right now, all of that's looking really good.
Now, Wade, how close are the Asian carp to this Brandon Road lockdown? How close have they been detected?
So the general mass of invasive carp has not moved much past the Interstate 55 by Joliet, Illinois there. But, you know, we're talking 10, 15 miles away from the Great Lakes.
But Wade, even if it's a slow movement, how long is it going to take to have this stuff in place? Is there a concern that we might be too late to have these measures in place?
Certainly, that's a concern. Right now, based on some of the eDNA data that you heard Amy talking about, we don't have a concern that there's a reproducing population in the Great Lakes of those invasive carp. So time is of the essence. There's no doubt about it.
Now, Amy, in the western part of Wisconsin where we have Asian carp, what are the borders now? How far have Asian carp moved from the Mississippi River inland into Wisconsin?
Actually, we just last year, our first reports of invasive carp in Wisconsin waters, and it was only on two of our tributaries, the Black River and the Chippewa River. And with those two rivers, they were found up to the first dam. So we're very fortunate to have a lot of these dams on our western side of the state to keep the invasive carp more on the Mississippi. But those are the only two real inland finds that we have discovered of invasive carp in Wisconsin waters.
So Wade, the timeline on this Brandon Road project, what's happening when?
Right now, we're actually at a really exciting juncture where there's two main increments. Increment one, which will add some of the large bubble curtains that we talked about earlier, and some of the acoustic speaker sound deterrents. And that increment is currently out for bids, with bids due back to the Army Corps of Engineers by August 28th of 2025. And so there will be some work done in that particular project, as well as some land acquisition work that the state of Illinois is working on with one of the utilities down there. That's actively ongoing. And then second, in the next couple of years, hope to finalize design and get funding and construction done for increment two. And that will add additional electrical deterrent barriers, a larger acoustic array, and a flushing lock. And that will hopefully occur in the next 2 to 5 years.
And finally, Amy, I know for some aquatic invasive species like mussels, we want people, if they're moving boats from one lake to another, well, to clean them up real good, make sure you're not letting them piggyback on your boat. Are there things that the public can do to help stop the spread of Asian carp or make sure they don't contribute to the spread of Asian carp, especially in those rivers in western Wisconsin where we had those first sightings last year?
Sure. Some really good deterrents is using bait from bait shops. The bait from a bait shop is all regulated bait that we know that is not invasive carp. Another thing is always empty out your live wells with the water, just in case there could be some not only invasive carp, but any kind of other invasive species within that water. You want to always drain your boat and your live wells, and always just make sure that there's no mud or plant material on your boat or your anchors or your trailer when you're removing it and going to another body of water. Another rule of thumb is usually try to, if you can, dry your equipment for a minimum of 5 days. That does get rid of not only invasive carp, but a lot of other invasive species that you wouldn't be transferring to another water body.
We'll leave it there. Amy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Wade, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
Amy Kretlow is an Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator at the Wisconsin DNR. Wade Strickland is Director of the Wisconsin DNR's Office of Great Waters. We talked to them about a $1.2 billion project to prevent invasive carp from entering Lake Michigan via the Illinois River and the state of invasive carp in Wisconsin waters. Now we'll hear from an environmental educator about the work she's doing with Wisconsin youth to detect invasive carp in our state's waters. Amy Workman is the director of the Upham Woods Outdoor Learning Center, which sits alongside the Wisconsin River north of the Wisconsin Dells. Amy, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Can you tell us about Upham Woods and the kind of work you do there in general before we dig into this this particular project?
Sure. Upham Woods Outdoor Learning Center is a residential program, which means that youth groups come and stay with us overnight. And so we have several different accommodations. We have cabins, we have a two-story dorm. And in the summertime, we also do an outpost camping program in tents for some groups. So it's all about connecting youth with positive outdoor experiences that are scaffolded so that they increase their level of skill and comfort and relationship with the outdoors and with each other over time.
When I think of outdoor activities for kids, you know, hiking and maybe orienteering, campfires, maybe tents, what I don't think about is genetic detective work in the waterways. What is going on with this environmental DNA hunt for these invasive carp?
Yeah, this project is really exciting and came about because, as you may know and your listeners may know, there was some invasive carp found below the Prairie du Sac Dam on the Wisconsin River way back in 2017. And so that raised the question of, are invasive carp found in other places in the Wisconsin River? And since we're located on the Wisconsin River, I thought this was an incredible way to engage youth in a really positive way where they're involved in the detective work of determining, or at least helping to determine, whether or not there's evidence of invasive carp in our section of the Wisconsin River.
All right. Now, if I'm a kid in this program, I'm a little old for it, but pretending, if I'm a kid in this program, what am I doing?
Sure. So first, you're learning about all the things we just talked about in terms of the impact of an invasive aquatic species on riverways and specifically invasive carp. But then what you do with that information is you take a kit, and we do this in six groups to six different locations that are along the Wisconsin River on Upham's campus. And the students actually collect a river sample, and then they filter it using an ultrafine microfiber filter paper. And then they cut up that paper into a tube that is a DNA extraction kit. And so the idea is all the cells that are shed from organisms in the Wisconsin River or that fall into the river are collected on that filter paper. Then the DNA extraction kit, they actually do the lab, which busts open all of those cells to release the DNA. That's the environmental DNA, is that it's that DNA that is in the environment, in this case, in water, that can be isolated. So they're collecting the samples, they're extracting the DNA from the cells that are captured in that filter paper. And then with all of the DNA mixed together from all of the different organisms, we are amplifying, and the students do this, we're amplifying just the DNA of interest, which in our case is our positive control, which is bluegill, because we know bluegill are in the Wisconsin River and we expect to find them. But then we also amplify, if present, two different species of aquatic invasive carp, and that is bighead and silver carp.
What has been the response from the young people doing this? It sounds like a lot of fun to me, as well as being educational.
It is, and that's kind of what we love about it, is that it is fun, but at the same time, they're learning so many things as they go. So one of our goals was to kind of expose the youth to the idea that science is a process. And so we have had students particularly say that, I'm so happy to be involved in a project that is real, that is not a cookie cutter lab where we know what the answer is because it's already been determined and the lab is set up such that we're trying to find kind of a predetermined answer. This is a big unknown. We don't know what we're going to find. And so it's really cool to have that real life mystery that we're helping to solve by engaging in this project.
If the students find, or the kids find, the bad news, they find that there's invasive carp DNA, do you report that to somebody then?
Oh, well, what we say and we make very, very clear to the youth that participate and the adults is that if we find evidence of invasive carp, that does not equal a
right.
live specimen of invasive carp in the Wisconsin River. It is one piece of evidence that then we can share such that the agencies that are involved in the mitigation and the control of invasive carp, like the DNR and like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, can do further experiments and further tests to confirm whether or not that is the case. So this is like the early detection, early warning system that we can engage students in, knowing that we're doing this in an outdoor learning center environment where there is a possibility of contamination. But this is really important because what it does is it helps those agencies kind of direct their resources, their limited resources, in more targeted ways.
Now, whether we're talking about young people or grown-ups, what do you see as the value of citizen science, getting non-scientists involved in helping out with this kind of environmental research?
Oh, it's a great, great question. I think broadly for everybody, youth and adults, it's really important that people understand that science is a process. And as we learn more, as we get better evidence and better data, we come to better conclusions about all kinds of environmental challenges and problems. But the second thing that I'm really excited about is that there's just so much bad news about the environment. And so youth particularly are hearing stories about extreme weather events, flooding, heat-related illnesses, wildfires, forever chemicals, microplastics. There's just so much bad news out there that I think it's really important that we give youth positive experiences in that they're not helpless. You know, there are ways to positively engage in addressing and solving some of these environmental challenges, and that they can be part of the solution. They don't just have to hear about the problems and then feel anxiety or depression or helplessness about it. They can engage in positive ways that enable them to be part of the solution in addressing these problems.
Amy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Amy Workman is director of the Upham Woods Outdoor Learning Center, which lies along the Wisconsin River north of the Wisconsin Dells. Talked to her about the work she's doing with Wisconsin youth to detect invasive carp in our state's waters. Earlier, we talked to DNR officials about the effort to keep invasive carp out of the Great Lakes.
Coming up, the creators of a new disability justice zine talk about the inspiration behind the project and what goes into making books accessible for people with visual disabilities.
So it's a lot more than a coloring book. There's open-ended prompts asking people to think about what hurts and what care they need.
Go inside the new zine called Crip Wisdoms. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Zines are growing in popularity as people seek out alternatives to digital spaces and their devices. Zines are tangible media we can hold in our hands.
For two UW-Madison graduate students, creating a zine together opened up possibilities to think about self-care through the framework of disability justice.
And with the help of a special publisher, they created a tactile version of the zine for blind readers that includes Braille and other textures to tell the story through touch.
Emily Knott is an artist, educator, and doctoral candidate in curriculum and instruction, and Miso Kwok is a doctoral candidate in special education. Their new zine is called Crip Wisdoms, a feminist disability studies coloring book, and they joined us recently in studio to talk about navigating the world with disabilities and their collaboration. Em begins by explaining how this project came into focus.
Well, the project started in a UW-Madison course. It was Dr. Sammy Schalk's Feminist Disability Studies course. And when we read the book, Kemi Nishida's book, Just Care, I immediately, as an artist scholar, saw images in my mind of what that page represented. So instead of bringing in my assigned one-pager for the class discussion, I brought in a coloring page. And thankfully, Dr. Schalk didn't say, you get an F because you were supposed to bring in a one-pager. She said, this is beautiful. You should keep doing it. You should make this thing a thing. You should finish it. You should make this book. And I almost immediately called Miso, a friend, co-conspirator, collaborator, and was like, do you want to do this thing with me? And thank goodness she said yes.
Miso, what piqued your interest about this project?
Oh, I think, first of all, just working with Emily always is a joy. So I was really excited that Em reached out to me. And yeah, it was just a lot of things kind of aligning really well. And I'm really grateful to have been part of this project and working together for this very meaningful and wonderful experience.
There's this long history behind the term CRIP, which can be viewed as an offensive term. It could also be empowering within some disability circles. And you decide to use it in the title of the book. What does that word mean to you?
Absolutely. So we join many disability justice activists and scholars in reclaiming the term CRIP, which has long been used to talk down to disability communities and instead reclaim it as a term of power and identity. And we also use a plural wisdoms to acknowledge that there's many ways of knowing and being in disability experience. And so that's how we came to the title of CRIP Wisdoms.
Yeah, as somebody who studies disability identity and someone just personally outside of my academic studies who has grappled and continues to grapple with my own identity as a disabled person and disabled scholar and what that means, I think reclaiming CRIP is a way for me to not only signify my pride and my solidarity with the community, but also invitation to others to rethink what this term means and, yeah, just kind of uplifting this term that has been historicized in a negative way into something that is powerful and that carries nuanced meanings.
Let's stay on the front cover here. There's also this row of illustrated spoons with different shapes and different designs. Can you talk about the spoon theory and how this concept helped you in your own life and why it's on the cover?
Sure. And I'll shout out Christine Miserandino, whose 2013 blog post was the first place where spoon theory was coined. But spoons, this quote is from Leah Lakshmi Pyepsna Samarasinha. She says, spoons is slang created by sick and disabled communities to describe units of energy and capacity, specifically within a sick and disabled context of having a limited amount of energy because of chronic illness or disability. And so when I put it on the cover, it was really thinking about ways in, because I felt like the ideas I encountered in feminist disability studies have helped me make sense of my own life and experiences. Particularly, I've had chronic migraines since I was 7 years old. And so having ideas at my fingertips like spoons and like bed activism were ways to not fold those experiences in on myself and hide them and feel shame about them, but instead enfold them into my identity and think about what they looked like and how I lived them every day. And so putting spoons on the cover was a way to say, everyone knows what a spoon is. You can hold it in your hand. It's something approachable. It's something you can look at and think about. And instead of having these ideas live kind of siloed, maybe in academic spaces, really making sure that a zine that's something anyone can look at and understand and read through and color and engage with, it was a way to give people almost an on-ramp into these ideas that for me and for so many other people have been really life-giving and life-affirming and have been an important part of our experiences and ourselves.
I wonder, Miso, when you are finding yourself out of spoons in any given day, do you have any tips or ways that you self-care? Or what happens when you're out of spoons?
Yeah, I think I'm actually a terrible person to give that answer because I am, you know, a very type A person who's, you know, pursuing a PhD, and that basically means that I've kind of conformed to this fast-paced, productive ideals, right? And so I think as I've kind of immersed myself in disability studies and just coming to know myself, I think I've been really trying to be better about that, what it means to care about myself and other. One, I think, is to know, like, when to take a break and actually take the break and carving out time for things like going outside for a walk or intentionally cooking something. So I think it is really challenging, but I'm constantly trying to do better and also encouraging my friends to take a day off when they need to take an afternoon off. Because most of the times I'm like really reiterating it to myself that a little bit of postponement doesn't really end up being the end of the world. And I think I just need to constantly remind myself and also others so that I can kind of start this culture of slowing down.
In the grand scheme of things,
yes.
It will all be the same in the end in some respects. And these spoons aren't just decorative. They're also dotted lines around them. You can cut them out. Your readers can cut them out. Why was it important to make them this way and not just, a text-based book, but an interactive zine?
So we really wanted this to be more than a coloring book. We, on each page, include not only the sources and citations and invitations to read more of the people that we're thinking with and quoting and citing, but also different ways in. So for the spoons page, you can cut out a spoon and write on it something you need and hand it to someone. Oh. Or you could write something that you have to offer and hand it to someone. There's pages near the end of the book where we actually ask people to draw and envision their own radical possibilities for disability justice and what they see in the future. So it's a lot more than a coloring book.
I think I saw somewhere that, there's never a dead end in this book, that there's always more possibilities for you to engage or to think or to reflect or color or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of my favorite parts of this book has been seeing it under other people's hands and hearts and eyes and minds and bodies and seeing how it transforms and how it gets used, getting messages from around the country of pages that have been colored or interacted with in people's classrooms and just seeing it come to life with other people.
We're talking about a new disability justice coloring book. It's called Crip Wisdoms, and it was created by two doctoral candidates at UW-Madison. M. Knott and Miso Kwok are with us in the studio to talk about their collaboration on this project, which blends art and disability justice. Miso, there are image descriptions throughout the book, and usually at this detailed paragraph describing what is shown on the previous page. How important are these image descriptions for you in your everyday life?
Very important is my short answer. So for listeners who are kind of curious why this conversation is coming up, so I'm a blind person and I cannot see any images, but we live in such a world that is very heavily driven by lots of different images, whether you are opening your phone to Instagram or whether you are kind of checking out a map. Some of my blind friends and I will kind of use this term of sighted world. So as a blind person living in the sighted world, I acknowledge and embrace the importance of images. And in fact, having been raised by a mathematics educator, I think I think a lot in images as well, for example, if I'm trying to understand a path from point A to point B, I'm kind of mentally imaging that path. So image is actually a really important part of my life as well. But obviously, kind of access to tactile image is very few and far, unfortunately. So text is a good way for me and many blind folks to understand what image is drawn or what image is being projected. And knowing that M is the visual artist and it was going to be about a coloring book, and I think it was really important for me to say I think we should include image descriptions and not just kind of the basic person is just like lying down on the sand and moon is on the background, and it's kind of intellectual ideas, but making sure that these ideas are widely understood as possible. So I think just that work of reviewing and writing image descriptions together was something that I cherish.
And that particular description is so vivid. And like it said, like femme, fat person on beach on their side, and conch shell as large as that. You know, I really love that aspect of it, Em, that these aren't just these aren't basic descriptions. They really paint a picture in your head.
And I think MISO really manifested that and made that true. We did so much work together iteratively because we were coming up with these images together. And so MISO would say, well, it looks like this. And I would say, okay, here's the thumbnail sketch. And this is over here. And what if it has this? So it was very much like this reflexive process of developing images and descriptions together that, and MISO, I love that you used the word cherish. I just smiled really big because I cherished that process too. It was really a beautiful process to engage in.
MISO, you brought about, you brought this tactile version of the book. And I'm wondering, can you tell us more about the features it includes?
Yeah. So kind of going back to the conversation around image, there is a technology educator who's also a blind person that I follow on the internet. Her name is Chansey Fleet. She coined this term image poverty to talk about how blind people are often deprived from exposure to image. And I really liked that term image poverty because I think it aptly captures this experience many blind folks have. And kind of thinking about this coloring book, first of all, like selfishly, I was thinking, okay, if this is a coloring book and if I'm part of this and if I can't color in the book because I don't know where to color, like that would be kind of, I would feel like I'm missing out.
You're missing out on it, yeah.
So that was kind of the selfish reason. But I really think that to engage in this idea of multiple ways of knowing and multiple identities being represented, I think it was really important for us to think about how to make this book as inclusive and as accessible as possible. And we are so grateful that we were able to connect with Clover Nook Printing House that really ran with this idea of, yeah, let's make these drawings into tactile images. It's really costly, both on the financial end and time-wise, to kind of produce graphics like this, and especially hand-drawn works like what M practices as an artist. So we are really grateful for their collaboration. And I think my hope is that having tactile books available will invite not only blind folks, but everybody to have a chance at engaging with images in a different way and in a more interactive way.
Well, Em and MISO, thank you so much for sharing this project with us.
Thank you so much
for having us.
That was Emily Knott and MISO Kwok. They are graduate students in education programs at UW-Madison, and we've been talking about their new coloring and activity zine called Crip Wisdoms. A Braille and tactile version of the zine is available through the publisher Clover Nook Press. And 100% of MISO and M's profits from the book are going to Disability Visibility Project. It is the season for candlelight hiking, snowshoeing, and skiing, with dozens of events set for around the state in the coming weeks, which has us wondering, do you go on night hikes in the winter months or participate in a candlelight event at a state park? Maybe there's a candlelight trail event in your own community with a bonfire and hot chocolate at the end. How does it feel to be out in nature on a cold, still night? Tell us about your candlelight hike experiences, and we'd love to share about them on a future program. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can reach us at this number, 888-642-0232, with a call or a text. And thanks for sharing your story about Wisconsin winter.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.